The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Let's step into our interview with Miss Lisa Allen Agostini. Good morning to you and welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM.
Pleasant morning. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. I know that the name is, you know, as some people say, a big name in terms of writing and your experience with playwrights and so on. But just tell us how you started, where you started, and just give us a story.
Well, the name is Lisa Allen Agostini, and it really started off as a small name, Lisa Allen. I borrowed some people's name. For branding, because Lisa Allen is common. Like, if you shout Lisa Allen in a crowded theater, they will arrest you. Too many people will run. So, you know, for branding purposes, I kept that. But, you know, I am originally from Mova. And I have been a writer most of my life. Thank God. And only God, because I sure didn't do it for the money. I have published many books over the years. I think some people will know me as a writer with The Express, The Guardian, and The Newsday over time. And I have, you know, been a columnist in The Guardian. I have published, like I said, a few books, poetry, Swallowing the Sky, published by Kane Arrow Press. That's Ian Diffenthaler's imprint. And I guess I'm best known for my fiction. The Bread the Devil Need is probably my best known book. It came out in 2001 and it was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. But as you said, you know, I've written in every genre there is. Mm-hmm. So I have, you know, done some stage stuff. I have done a little bit of stage stuff, not as much as I would like. I've written some humorous short films which are online. I am a stand-up comedian, and I was a part of a kind of experimental feminist comedy duo called Femcom. COVID killed that, but God is still good.
Combination with Lourdes?
Yeah, Femcom was with Lourdes, and I was so happy to see her on Saturday at Metropolitan Book in Arapita Avenue, where I was given a little christening to my new baby book called Death in the Dry River. Mm-hmm. And she came and she gave it a little blessing. So I was very happy to see her there. Yeah, she did a little comedy video for me. So I posted it, of course.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so from the story with The Bread the Devil Need, what influenced that story and what is it really about?
Right. Well, The Bread the Devil Need, as you know, the phrase as a trini, that, you know, if you don't change your behavior, basically, if you don't look at what you are doing, the consequences of your actions will be that you're going to eat the bread the devil need. And this book is about a red woman, I think originally from Aranjuez or somewhere. And she's living in Lansmitan, and her husband, her boyfriend, she's living with. Nice guy, beautiful, very talented, sexy for days, but he beats her like a rug. And she has this like private life of her abuse, and just one day she shares it with somebody, and that act kind of precipitates, you know, her life changing, and she's delivered from the relationship and into a whole new life, basically. People have very strong responses to the book because it's very brutal in how it reveals dynamics and actions of abuse within intimate relationships, but also within families, because part of the idea of The Bread the Devil Need is that her family history includes child sexual abuse. So it's really looking at how these behaviors or patterns of behavior manifest in people's behavior later on in their lives and even generations down.
I was now about to ask you, what are some of the difficult topics you've tackled within your stories, from your plays and to into your story, your novels? So you've tackled, as you say, the process of being in a relationship and moving through from, you know, the love and, oh, I'm in love and in love, then the abuse stage and the exit stage, and then new life after that. What were some of the reactions that you got from tackling those types of issues?
Well, you know, in my previous work, I have dealt with things like, my young adult novel, Home, for example, is about trigger warning, suicide. It's about a teenage girl who attempts suicide, and we really go through, and the girl from like Marabella or something like that, and her family kind of sends her to Canada in exile. So we go through what it's like to experience some mental illness conditions that might make you want to feel that way. And look at, you know, it also has like a queer couple in the book. So I'm used to difficult subjects. In the case of The Bread the Devil Need, looking at child sexual abuse and gender-based violence, it's something that I covered a lot as a journalist. It's also part of, well, I think many of us in this country and worldwide have some kind of family connection with the topic. So I think it's an important topic to talk about, because even though it is hard, and there were people who came up to me and said, girl, that is my story. How did you know? I cannot read that book. It is bringing up too much stuff. But there are also people who are like, I never knew this happened in the way that you present it in the book. And it never occurred to me that the woman sitting next to me and smiling with me could be being abused at home. And maybe next time I will ask a question or treat the subject differently.
So it gave an awareness that many people weren't even recognizing that is what they were seeing.
Correct. Because you see behaviors like somebody coming to work late every day, every couple of weeks they have to take a day. They're always kind of limping or like, you know, body pains or something. And then you don't connect, because they never come and say, girl, my man has beat me so bad. Or a guy even might come and say, you know, how his wife has given him trouble, but, you know, he might be home getting serious licks. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of abuse that's being concealed day to day. And I want to say that it's not just Trinidadian women who come up to me and Tobagonian women who come up to me and say these things. Huh?
It's a worldwide issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you as well, as a former journalist, how has the landscape changed for you in terms of writing, the authenticness of it, the form of storytelling? How has it changed over the years?
There's a really, really famous journalist from the Boston Globe who I really admired, but she got into deep, deep, deep trouble because she started to bring her fiction and her made-up stuff into her journalism. And I bless God that I did not do that. That, you know, there's a line at my... Well, okay, I didn't do it consciously, I should say. But there's a line between the journalistic work in investigations of real people, real stories, real situations, and reporting it honestly and without bias as much as possible. And on the other hand, taking a very close and intimate look at a character or a situation and having a bias, having a perspective, because in fiction, you have to have a perspective. You know, if your voice doesn't have a perspective, that's a flaw. So you go from trying to be objective and completely like looking at the situation from a remove to actually figuring out ways in which to insert yourself in the situation. So it's a different approach. I don't do as much journalism anymore. That has repercussions for me financially, because making a living as a creative writer, especially but not only in Trinidad and Tobago, is extremely challenging. There's no system set up for people like me in terms of arts patronage. Mm. There is only selling your art, there is selling yourself, and trying to, what they call, monetize your assets. So I have chosen to instead to focus on creation And unfortunately, in literature, that is a slow and painful process and does not always yield many financial. But I sit here looking at a stack of my books and I say, you know, God is good. I have no money, but I have books. Look at that.
And the thing is, you brought up a very interesting topic, the idea of Patreons and, you know, what's the other word I'm looking for? I don't want to say donators, but Patreons is the word that comes up to mind. That type of structure happens more, let's say, in England and in America, where, you know, the art history and writing and so on, as you say, was probably a little more accepted and really pushed forward as a means to show, you know, inclusiveness, and in some cases it was a show of wealth when you have a Patreon. How can we put that system here in Trinidad and Tobago? Because we are just as talented, probably even more so. And I remember when working with Belmont there, Richard Young and the cloth, and being part of that, Robert Young as well. The upstairs area, there was an artist who came and spent some time in residence. And those things you don't really hear about much in TNT. Do you think that is something that we could look into to promote the arts?
So I will take it back a little bit and say that the system of arts patronage is as old as art, because there have always been wealthy people who wanted to show off how civilized they are.
Mm-hmm.
In civilized countries. And I'm not joining the hashtag Trinidad is not a real place debate, but I will say that our multimillionaires in this country don't understand that. And they understand displays of wealth as acquisition of things. It has to do with our plantation economy foundation. Many years ago, I was really privileged to be in class with Ken Critchlow when he explained to me for the first time that art is not a thing in this country because we're plantation and slaves don't make art. So when we're still in a plantation economy, we can debate about symbols, and when we know that the designer of our national, the thing that we're debating now, the crest, the national coat of arms.
The coat of arms, yes. Mm-hmm. And
he wasn't paid for it, bless him. You understand?
So this is Carlisle Chang.
We are in a plantation. Girl again, my vex. Oh God, let me talk about the book now. Death in the Driver, but it's a lovely little novel.
No, but just to close off that part of it though, they have hired an artist, a jeweler as a matter of fact, to create the final design. I just want to get her name correctly, because this is going to be a debate. Jillian as well. Bishop. Pardon?
Jillian Bishop.
Jillian Bishop has been chosen to create the design. So maybe that is the beginning of understanding our positioning in how we consider art and writing, and I guess finally starting that chapter of finding the acceptance and giving it the recognition that it deserves. But let's talk about your new book as well. Tell us what the influence is about, and what was the starting trigger to write that book?
Wow. Okay. So my new book is a novella. It's a short novel, meaning you will finish it within about, if you're a slow reader, about 4 hours to 6 hours. If you're a fast reader, you will chop this up over lunch and tea. It's a historical crime novella, meaning it is set in Port of Spain in 1932 in Duke Street. It begins on Duke Street. And the titular death in the Dry River is a Calypsonian who's found face down in the Dry River there. And so the story is crime fiction. It's like a noir. It's like, you know, that, you know, like, you know, the detective in his little fedora hat, and he's like wearing suspenders, and he have his foot cocked up on the desk, and the dame walks in. It's that kind of story, but set in Trinidad, a set in Port of Spain more solidly. I mean, literally, people really appreciate the fact that you can walk this Port of Spain. Like, if you read the book and you know town, you can walk this Port of Spain. So a lot of, you know, of the early readers have appreciated that. it's historical in that it's deeply researched, but the story is not true. The story is fiction. There was no police constable Johnson, Sonny Stone, who was originally from Toku, but found himself in, you know, he didn't exist. But I did look up in the police museum, and thanks to, you know, the late, great Jerry Besson, may he rest in peace, I got a lot of information about early policing in Trinidad, a lot of information about how people interacted with the police and so on. And really grateful for that research. I also went and looked into the, not the National Archives so much, but look, the Heritage Library at Nellis.
Mm-hmm.
And the West Indiana Special Collections Library at UE St. Augustine. And really, I looked into the history of cocoa production because that's kind of seminal to his backstory. At the turn of the 20th century, there was a cocoa boom, and that had repercussions for all levels of society. And then there was a cocoa bust, which had repercussions more so for certain, you know, sectors of society. But looking at that and looking at just the history of Porto Spain, so the book is very much about the social strata. So you meet all kinds of people from the city, from the very poor to the very rich, from the white sort of owning class and actual colonials. To Venezuelan immigrants. It's very much like the city we have today, unfortunately.
And that kind of, you know, actually is an interesting point, because the way in which you say, well, it didn't really change much, how does that rate us as a citizenship, as a community, as some you know, people who are supposed to be understanding their past so that they will know how to move towards the future? Does that bode well for us? If it is, as a writer, you can say, well, it hasn't really changed much, you know. What do you think about that?
History works in cycles, and that you will find that things come around again. It's not unique to Trinidad and Tobago. And also the stubborn human clinging to bad behavior and selfishness and clannishness, tribalism, short-sightedness, greed, nepotism, all of these things are human traits. We can't wash them off. What we need to do is, like, think more deeply about how they affect. So if you come up knowing that you cannot go to the bank and get a loan, why would you be happy to know that for generations after you, they will also not be able to get up and go to the bank and get a loan? We need to figure out different ways of doing things and different ways of structuring our connections so that we are not, A, gripped by capitalism, and B, understand that also with all the horrible traits we have inherited, we also have inherited love, we have inherited grace, we have inherited the ability to communicate and to learn and to develop and change. Flexibility is also part of the human condition, or we would still be apes walking around on our knuckles. I mean, some of us are still apes walking around on our knuckles, so I'm not sure how this argument is being advanced. But we have the capacity to change, Tosca. Adaptation is part of the human genome. And so, just encourage. And it's not like, it's not a blanket over society. It's an individual decision.
Yep. And then the process of understanding, well, that's the choice that they made, and for others to accept it. That's another part of the social, you know, cycle that tends to be forgotten as well. I wanted to talk to you about your future projects. What do you have in mind? Are you going to go back to writing plays? How is the play art theatre? What is that environment like now?
I was really, really, really thrilled to see Roma Spencer's piece on Calypso Rose. I totally was swept away by her ambition and the breadth of her vision. And I love that for us. I want to see that play, that musical, on Broadway, off Broadway. I want to see it in Vegas for years. I want to see Calypso Rose running in Vegas in perpetuity.
Like, she just might have the strength to do it, you know.
Yeah.
She has the boldness to do it.
Girl, you don't know how that warmed my heart, and I saw it. I saw it as, you know how Lion King goes all over the world and tours, and everybody knows, iconic like that. I want that for her. So in that regard, I have, you know, I'm a bit of a hermit. I must confess, I've not been going out, but I know that there are a number of really bold new, for example, there's the new playwrights workshop. There is a lot of activity around that. There's also a new play festival at UWE that goes on. So I know there's activity happening. I'm a hermit. I'm not the right person to talk about it. But I've not been writing for stage for a few years. The last thing I had in mind to write for stage was, anyway, that was something about my spiritual Baptist grandmother, but it hasn't happened. And Tony Hall has since passed, so I'm not sure how we're going to realize it, because he was my dramaturg. But God is still good, and his mercy still endures forever. So I want to say, though, that coming up on Sunday, please God, I leave Trinidad for a few months to go to Iowa in the United States on an international writing program fellowship. I'll be there for 11 weeks doing writing a new project that I have, which is a memoir in poetry. And so I'm really focused on that. And while I'm in the States, I'm also going to be doing the official launch, not the little home christening, the official launch in the big church and thing at the Center for Fiction in Brooklyn on the 7th of September.
Congratulations.
It's high noon at the Center for Fiction, and it's going to be, the launch will take place as part of the Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival, a festival of which I'm so deeply, deeply, deeply proud and like big cheerleader. And I'm going to be interviewed by another Trinidadian writer. His writing name is P. Jelly Clark, and he has like quite a renown in history and speculative fiction writing. And I am really looking forward to the conversation, to the festival. I will only be there for a day because I'm running away from my fellowship to go and do it, but looking forward to launching Death in the Dry River at the Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival on September 7th.
So the thing is, I think more information like that, as in the types of fellowships and opportunities that are there for writers, be more available to those. So in your final piece of advice, two questions I have for you, for those young writers who are listening. How do you find your muse? And what would be the best piece of advice that you've received that you'd be willing to pass on to the young writers?
How do you find your muse? I'd say pray about it in whatever way that you know how to pray, whether that prayer takes the form of a meditation, whether it takes the form of, well, actual prayer with your mouth and things, or whether it is just spending time deeply contemplating what it is you feel you are here to do. The Lord is my muse, and he is the one who directs and guides my creativity. And I love that for me. So, you know, if you are a creative person, you're in touch with the source. That is, the creativity does not come from you, but through you. So get in touch with the source and talk to the source. Find out what it is that you are here to do. Ask, you will be answered, you know. So the second thing, in terms of advice I've been given, I don't know. I wouldn't say advice, but what I'll say is this. If you are a writer, write. And writing is not just one act of putting a pen to paper or typing things in with your fingers or even speaking the words into existence. The act of writing is a psychological journey from your inspiration to your research to your it had a kusume. Do not imagine you're going to sit down and write something and it'll be perfect. Let the ideas kusume, and also let the work kusume, so you could come back after a week and look at it and say, oh, shucks, I can say that better.
Well, you know, you might have to give a definition for what kusume is, because not many would know. Yeah, you know, that's
so when you're cooking,
Creole.
Right? when you are cooking, the French, I think the word is consommé. It is to allow something to cook down until all the essential juices of it kind of blend together in the pot. And it is a long, slow stewing process that brings out the flavor. In Trinidad, we call it kusume. If the thing don't kusume, you're not going to get the good flavor. So allow your ideas to stew down. Let the juices come out. Let it soften up a little bit. Let the flavors become harmonized in the pot. Don't rush it. Let it kusume. That's my advice.
Yeah, and I guess patience as well, because if for it to stew, you have to have patience and not rush the pot, you know?
Correct, that's right. Pressure cooker does not taste the same as long slow stew.
You understand? All right, Miss Allen Agostini, it was a pleasure speaking with you, and congratulations on your successes and fellowship. And here's to the new book selling off the shelves.
Thank God and bless God, and thank you. Death in the Dry River is also available online. Just look for it on wherever you buy books online. You can order a copy. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really just overwhelmed. Thank you so much. You're very kind.
Blessings to you.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.